Welcome to the Judiciary Committee, the State Senate. Today is Thursday, February 17th, 2005. Now about 8:38 a.m. Senator Huggins, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins are present. I believe Senator Terrio will be joining us. Is Senator Guest online today?
Nope.
Okay. We will proceed where we left off yesterday. And Joyce, if you said you had an answer to a question that we asked yesterday. So if you'll put yourself on the record again for us this morning, we're eager to hear what your answer is.
Good morning, committee members. I'm Joyce Anderson, Administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. One of the questions yesterday that was asked, I'm not sure by which senator, was we were talking about which employees are covered by the Legislative Ethics Code, and there are certain employees that are exempt. And I had mentioned at the time that the committee had also had exempt additional employees other than those that are listed in statute. And the question was, did the committee have the authority to do that? So I did a little research on that. If you go to 2469-90, which is the definitions in the ethics statute, and go to A9. I'm sorry.
2469-90?
I-90. I'm sorry, A11.
Got it.
It gives a definition of a legislative employee, and when you get down to the bottom of the section there after the semicolon, it says, it does not include individuals who perform functions that are incidental to legislative functions, including security, messenger, maintenance, and print shop employees, and other employees designated by the committee. I think the question from the Senate Judiciary Committee was, did the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics have the authority to designate other employees? And what had happened was that the committee did take a look at that, and they exempted employees that are range 15 and below, which would be in legal research. So that was in addition to the employees that were listed in this particular section, as well as in administrative services, the tour guide. So they added several different classifications to the ones that were already listed there. So I just wanted to point that out to the committee that when the ethics code came into being, the committee decided that they would look at that particular section since they had the authority to do that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Huggins.
Joyce, thank you, Mr. Chair. Joyce, the question of compelling members to vote on the floor, given the conflict of interest unless they're is voted and decided they don't have to. That was asked to me last week, kind of in a break. And I went around this week and talked to different people who have been around a long time, and I said, what do you think about this? And they said, it's absolutely the right thing to do. 100% of the people I talked to, people I respect very much, because they said their experience is if you give people a chance to take cover from dodging votes, they will dodge the votes. Is that your experience with, or your thought, or what's your take on that procedure?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, I would agree with you. I checked with Barbara Craver, who is our legal advisor, yesterday afternoon, and she did not do research, but her belief is that this has been in place always, that the full body would have to excuse the individual member, but she's not sure, so we haven't had time to do research on that. I can see where certain legislators may want to take advantage of it by saying that they didn't want to vote. If that's what you're saying,
right.
I agree with that.
Right.
The committee did look at that issue when they issued their advisory opinion 04-02 last year. That was part of the discussion at the committee meeting. I could certainly provide you with those minutes, but I seem to remember at the time that the question had come up why there hasn't been a case other than the one that I mentioned yesterday where a legislator was not allowed to vote on a particular issue. And they debated that back and forth, and I think that the committee's feeling was that that's really the legislature's decision how they want to handle that. We can put in the ethics code what the conflict is, what the financial interest is, and if it says in the uniform rules right now that everyone must say that the person should not vote, otherwise they must.
Right.
I think the committee's feeling was is that it should be left to the legislature.
Yeah, I would appreciate if I could get a copy of that later on. Thank you very much. I appreciate your professionalism in that.
It is something that's left to the legislature, Huggins. It's in the uniform rules.
Right.
And the uniform rules are not subject to review by anybody other than the legislature.
Right.
Okay. Other questions that may have come up in members' minds between last night and this morning? Senator Cario has joined us, as we knew he would. Joyce, as we were going down through this, one of the things that you mentioned was that you thought maybe staggered terms might be something that would be beneficial to the operation of the committee. And I would appreciate it if you'd give us some kind of a suggestion on how that might be structured after this meeting is over sometime, as we continue to look at how we want to suggest changes in the ethics laws. Okay, now I guess I have a couple questions as I get into the structure, so that it's very clear. I know you're not speaking. We're going to give you the same disclaimer we gave you yesterday. You're not speaking on behalf of the committee, but you're speaking on behalf of your understanding as the professional staff person of the committee. In your understanding, and I see that Mr. Thomas is also online, if there are any questions that we need to refer to him. I think he's the chair at the moment, isn't he?
He's the acting chair, yes.
Okay. So we could also, for the members' benefit, know that Connor Thomas is online. The applicability of this 2460, the legislative ethics law, the applicability, who does it apply to? Just to review. It looks to me it's in section 020.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. It applies to current sitting legislators, it applies to legislative employees, and it applies to certain employees of the legislative affairs agency, such as LIO staff and other staff.
So this basically governs the individual actions of individual legislators and individual employees. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And it could maybe have some effect on a past legislator. A former legislator.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. If a complaint is filed, there are stipulations in statute that the allegations stated within the complaint must be within a certain time frame if the legislator has already left office.
Have there been that nature of complaint in the past?
Yes, there has, Mr. Chair.
Is it a large number, a small number? Have there been any that have gone beyond or that have not been dismissed, that have been forwarded for any kind of charges or referral?
Mr. Chair, during my time here, and I'd have to do some research other than that, but since June of 2001, we've had one complaint. Dealing with a former member of the legislature, and no, that did not move forward to a public hearing.
Okay. I guess I was just trying to figure out what we were trying to correct if someone no longer is in the body or is no longer an employee of the body. So I've had several comments that say, well, gee, how I'm gone. Where is the concern? But I don't know. I'm not going to ask the nature of the complaint. But I just specifically wondered if it was a large number or a small number. So there's been one since you've been there and it was dismissed. excuse me. So as I look through this, and then I go move down to the standards of conduct. The standards of conduct there, once again, looks to me like that it all applies to individual legislators and individual actions. Is there any indication in this statute in your mind that this statute has any effect on the uniform rules of the legislature?
Mr. Mr. Chair, from information that we have received in the past and in the recent advisory opinion that was issued, it does state in there that the uniform rules are under the control of the legislature. So that I would go with what has been told to the committee.
I mean, it's fairly clear now if I look at the statute. If I look at the statute, to me, that the uniform rules are under the control of the legislature. But it isn't the statute that that gives the legislature that authority, is it? Let me not make you answer that question.
I didn't quite understand the question,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Let me make it clear. I look at a number of things on that regard, and I just want to make sure, because what I'm concerned with is that we're very clear in the statutes that tell the committee how to operate, that we don't ask them to operate in an area in which there's really no authority, and thereby set up a conflict. In other words, our statute has to be very clear, and it has to comply with constitutional mandates as well. And so, as I've listened to the discussion on the operation of the committee, I'm not being critical of the committee, because I think that the statute in the past may have been, the new statute's a little more clear in my main mind, but the statute may have indicated to the committee that there was work to do in an area in which it was a legislative responsibility to take care of any kind of a concern. So let me just see if we're on the same page here. If I look at the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and I go under Article 2, Section 12, it says the houses of each legislature shall adopt uniform rules of procedure. So the legislature's authority to adopt uniform rules comes from the Constitution and not from statute. And this is how I interpret it. Do you agree? I mean, I'm not asking you to be a lawyer or a constitutional lawyer, just an impression at this point.
I would agree.
From there, we get into our uniform rules, and each year the legislature, each session, the legislature adopts uniform rules. The 24th legislature, for example, has adopted the 12th legislature first session as amended 85, 88, 89, 91, 98, 2001, 03, and 04 as the uniform rules of the legislature. And then it adopts, as part of those uniform rules, Rule 53, Rule 55 says that the rules of parliamentary practice comprised in Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure, 2000 edition, implement and govern the uniform rules of the legislature in all cases not covered by these uniform rules. So our uniform rules say there are two authorities that we, under which we have implemented our constitutionally authorized powers. Under the rules as published in this yellow book and under the Mason's Manual. As I read through the Mason's Manual, it was interesting to me to note a number of things, and just let me kind of lay this out. I look under Part 1, Section 4, Paragraph 2. The rules of legislative procedure are derived from several sources and take precedence in the order listed below. The principal sources are as follows. First, A is constitutional provisions and judicial decisions thereon. B would be adopted rules, which we have. C would be custom, usage, and precedence. And D would be statutory provisions. E would be adopted parliamentary authority, and F would be parliamentary law. Paragraph 4 says, whenever there is a conflict between rules from these sources, the rule from the source listed earlier prevails over the rule from the source listed later. For example, when where the Constitution requires three readings of bills, this provision controls over any provision of adopted laws, statutes, adopted manual, or parliamentary law. So in a question of parliamentary procedure, if the question is addressed to the proper authority to try to determine what it is, we look at these things in that hierarchical order. So what I'm concerned with is that in a statute, we may have a provision that's contrary to our adopted rules, in it contrary to our customs, usage, and precedents, that could put the committee in a position where they felt that by the statute they have to examine something that's outside of that's at a lower hierarchical position in authority than the ones that are above it. And I don't want to have that kind of a conflict arise, because it's not good for anybody. So I guess when what I'm trying to say is, through 0402, I think that was the number that you had, was it the one on the uniform rules that you had recently?
It was 0403.
0403. It appears that you guys were looking at statutory provisions as somehow or another controlling uniform rules. And I'm just wondering if that was the case. Where were you looking for your authority to examine uniform rules and practices of the legislature?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to say a couple things, and then I would like to ask you to ask Connor Thomas to also speak.
I will be glad to do that. I'm not trying to challenge the work product. If I'm going to challenge that, I'll challenge it in the body where I think my authority lies. I'm just trying to, I guess, figure out, is there something in the statute that would conflict here with the uniform rules?
Mr. Chair and committee members, first of all, let me give you a little bit of background about getting ready for the committee, background material for the committee to actually look at this advisory opinion request. Went back to the original inception of the committee in 1993, at which point by statute the committee was required to propose open meeting guidelines at that time. So the committee set up a subcommittee and reported to the main committee. Then the committee made some the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics made some recommendations on open meeting guidelines. In those open meeting guidelines were notice requirements. Those were listed in the open meeting guidelines that were proposed. I'd have to go back and look and see exactly what it said. I don't have that with me, but I know that was in there. So that is part of the history that was provided to the committee when they looked at this particular request for an advisory opinion. There were also
the advisory opinion was requested by two members of the Senate?
Yes.
Okay. Who did not, to your knowledge, did they bring the question as a point of order to the body before they came to the committee?
That I don't know.
Okay.
It was requested by Senator Lyman Hoffman and Senator Donnie Olson.
Do you remember if that question was ever brought as a point of order, Mr.?
It was not.
Senator, thank you.
So in preparing for the committee to look at the advisory opinion request to see whether it was something the committee should respond to, I did some background material, and as I said, there were pulled out the previous open meeting guidelines from 1993, or I believe it was actually 1994 by the time they were formulated, and provided that to the committee at that time, and notice requirement was in there. We also had in the file two memos from Tam Cook, both as the Director of Legal Services, that also dealt with this particular subject. And so those were provided to the committee. The one memo that Tam Cook prepared, which was on February 14th, 1997, does state that the, and they were asking about notice requirements. I won't read the whole thing, but it says, the issue you raised presents a question of compliance with open meeting requirements. So she felt at that time that notice requirement was directly with open meeting requirements. In the second memo, which is dated January 19th, 1995, actually that was 1995, the one I just mentioned was 97, also that information, which I can give you copies of. So the committee had that particular information as well as the guidelines that were proposed in the past. And so the committee looked at that information and took that information into consideration that notice requirements were at one time considered part of open meeting, were going to be proposed as part of open meeting guidelines. So that's the background that was provided to the committee.
Okay. And I got a couple questions there. And other members, if you have questions, feel free to nudge me if I get too focused here. In preparing for this, did you review the uniform rules in Mason's manual?
The copy of the uniform rules were given along with the materials that were handed out. Yes.
Were they reviewed to find out the rules of legislative procedure?
You mean in relation to Mason's manual?
Mason's manual, uniform rules were.
No, I did not provide anything from Mason's manual. I provided a copy of the uniform rules that dealt with this particular subject.
Okay. Yeah, see, and I'm not being critical. Uniform rules says where you don't find something in the uniform rules, you refer to Mason's manual. So Mason's manual was adopted by the legislature as part of the uniform rules. And I'm just wondering if regardless of the memo that TAMS put out that said these are considerations, if anyone looked at the hierarchy of how you determine legislative procedure and whether or not, in looking at the statute, you considered custom, which is a higher level of consideration rather than the statute.
Mr. Chair and committee members, once the information was put together, a copy was sent to Barbara Craver, who is our legal counsel, and she was the one that actually would draft the opinion for.
I saw both opinions that she drafted.
Yes.
One that was refused by the committee, and the other one after the committee told her what they wanted her to draft.
Yeah, I don't think I'm really concerned.
Yes, there were two different opinions.
Okay. And if I read it correctly, in the dialogue, it was, well, the opinion will draft the opinion according to how the committee wants it to read. Kind of along that line, paraphrasing it.
That may be.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Theriault.
Do we have access to those in our packet here?
Did we?
I took the opinion off the website that Select Committee on Legislative Ethics provided. The second opinion that I have.
This is 0403 we're talking about now? The advisory opinion?
Yes. But there are two opinions.
There was one that was a draft opinion that was written by Ms. Craver, I believe, that said there is no violation, and the committee instructed her to draft a second opinion to indicate that there was a violation. Is that correct?
Yes, there were two drafts.
Secretary?
Yes, there were two drafts, but was there an instruction to change the legal interpretation?
The committee, Mr. Secretary, through the chair, the committee felt through their discussion that the advisory opinion should be redrafted, yes.
Was there ever any discussion in the committee consideration of the Mason's manual?
I'd have to look back in the minutes, Mr. Chair, but I do believe that came up, but I can't tell you what the discussion was.
Senator,
Chairman, have you listened to a tape of the meeting?
I couldn't find a tape recording of the meetings. Do you tape record your meetings?
Yes, they are, and they are also in the archives.
Okay.
I do have copies with me today of the minutes of the meetings that we had, except for the one on January 7th. Being the sole staff person for the committee, I haven't had time to do the minutes yet for January 7th, but I do have the other minutes with me.
We could get staff to make copies for folks.
There's also copies in here of the two memos that were prepared by Tam Cook.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator French,
just so I can get myself, because I think you've been bearing down this question maybe a little more carefully than I have, but I just want to make sure I understand sort of where we're going with the line of questioning right now. And it seems to be that the suggestion is that the select committee failed to consider that custom
and usage
would trump a statute.
That's correct.
And that the committee was in error for relying on a statute when it should have relied on custom. Is that the point you're trying to make?
Let me frame it a little bit differently, Senator. Let's go to the uniform rules. Let's go to the Mason's Manual. And you're a student of the Mason's Manual. I've heard you've quoted many times on the floor.
We run by Mason's, Mr. Chairman, and that's only to be expected.
Right. Let's go to Section 13 of the Mason's Manual.
I didn't bring my copy. Maybe we could take a break.
Can we take a break?
Yeah.
And allow people to get their Mason's
Manual. Thank you.
Recess. And again, I want to make sure I'm not back on the record. And Mr. Thomas, are you with us now? Okay. Are you there?
I was trying to be with you a little bit earlier, but I didn't hear anything.
We had a technical problem, and it's been corrected. So I apologize. It has been being recorded, I think, by KTOO. So, but where we are, Mr. Connors, right now, we're just taking a look at trying to determine the uniform rules and how they would apply to the 0403 decision. Just what we're trying to do is to determine if the legislature has put the committee in a position, an untenable position, of trying to determine something over which they have no authority, and whether we need to make it very clear in our statutes exactly what the authority is. So we're now moving to page 22 of the Mason's Manual. And for the record, I'll look at Rule 3, which the power of a House of Legislature to determine its rules and proceedings is a continuous power. It can always be exercised by the House and is absolute and beyond the challenge of any body or tribunal if the rule does not ignore constitutional restraints or violate fundamental rights. Rule 4, a legislative House cannot tie its own hands. By establishing unchangeable rules, it may adopt and change procedure at any time and with no other notice than the rules may require. Rule 5, rules of procedure passed by one legislature or statutory provisions governing the legislative process are not binding on a subsequent legislature. Rule 7. Rules of procedure are always within the control of the majority of a deliberative body and may be changed at any time by a majority vote. Now, those rules would lead me to believe, and in discussions with legal counsel for the legislature, would lead me to believe that the legislature has the absolute authority to control its own rules. No one can challenge them, no tribunal can challenge them, and that even a statute such as the Open Meeting Act that was established by the 23rd legislature would not be binding on the 24th legislature unless the 24th legislature were to adopt those provisions in its uniform rules. That appears to be the constitutional provision that I see. So are we putting you in a position where we task you to do something with a statute that we cannot ask you to do? Now let me go a little farther so that we can get all of what part of my research has shown. Now if we go to Section 14, Rule 3, 24, the purpose of rules is to aid a body to perform its duties more efficiently and with fairness to its members. Section
Section 15, Rule 4, under a constitutional provision declaring that each house of the legislature shall determine the rules of its own proceedings, the fact that a house acted in violation of its own rules or in violation of parliamentary law is a matter clearly within its power, does not make its action subject to review by the courts. If a violation of the rules is not subject to review by the courts, how could it be subject to review by a citizens' committee? Let's go on down to section 51 on page 47. Rule 1. A public body cannot delegate its powers, duties, or responsibilities to any other person or groups, including a committee of its own members. Rule 2, where duties or responsibilities are imposed on a public body as on a state legislature, that body is bound to exercise those duties and responsibilities and cannot divest itself of them by delegation to others. So in the enforcement of the rules and in the interpretation of the rules, we as a legislature cannot divest ourselves of that responsibility or delegate it to others, according to the rules that we adopt. It appears to me that the statute and the rules are in conflict. And under such case, because it's our mandate under the Constitution to establish rules, we can't do what we've done or asked you to do. I may be wrong, but I'm trying to get it squared away. Go ahead, Joyce.
Question. I thought I heard you say that unless the open meetings statute is adopted every year by the legislature under the uniform rules, it doesn't apply. Is that what you said, Mr. Chair?
What I say is that the rules don't care, the statutory provisions that affect the uniform rules, if it was passed by a legislature, I'm not even positive that we can pass a statute that would affect it under the rules and make it be effective, because the rules say we can change a rule anytime we want to by a vote of 50, by a majority. The uniform rules say even a rule that says that we have to have two-thirds vote in order to change the rules can be changed by 51%. And this is a body of rules that has been around for a long time. And it's a very complicated, it's not complicated, but it is weighty. And there's a lot to it. And in trying to interpret how that comes down, it appears to me that if the proper procedure for the senators who filed the question with you under the rules would have been to raise a point of order with the body, which at that time the president of the Senate, Senator Theriault, would have made a ruling, and if the body did not unanimously agree with that, the body would vote. And if a majority voted for his ruling, then it would be a precedent, just like in a court of law. If the body voted down his ruling, he could attempt again. But the ruling still would have to be made somewhere on a point of order. So to take a matter that is controlled by the uniform rules outside of the body and delegate the responsibility to interpret the uniform rules there is something that, according to the uniform rules, we could not do. Senator Theriault.
Mr. Chairman, and I forget the exact case, but a lot of this has been argued before in the courts, where the courts have said the legislature is a pure democracy, and by a vote of 50% or 50% plus one, they dictate how they conduct their business. I mean, that has been litigated, I believe.
It has.
I believe all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Let me give you a quote, because I really love this book, by the way. It helps me tremendously. It's the Alaska's Constitution, the Citizen's Guide. This is the fourth edition, and it gives me a great deal of background and information and commentary that I think is very helpful to me as a legislator, so I endorse this book. But
Let's look up page 58 of this book, and let me just read a portion of a state Supreme Court decision having to do with the uniform rules. And if you'll remember, this goes back to the legislative coup in 1981 to replace the Speaker of the House, and the charge was that it violated the joint rules. It was Malone versus Meekins, 650 P. 2nd, 351, 1982. Here's the quote. "We can think of few actions which would be more intrusive into the legislative process than for a court to function as a sort of super parliamentarian, to decide the varied and often obscure points of parliamentary law which may be raised in the course of a legislative day. Thus, even though the uniform rules may have been violated, such violation is solely the business of the legislature and does not give rise to a justifiable claim." So if the state Supreme Court says we can't intervene in uniform rules, how can we expect that a citizens' committee could do that? That's my dilemma. I think you see where I hope you see where I'm coming from. We're tasking you with something that the Supreme Court said even they can't do. Senator Terrio.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, so many times, even when we tried something with a law, you bump up against the Constitution. And sometimes you love the Constitution, and sometimes it's a frustration. But it is basically, as you've sort of, tied things, one string to a strand to another, the basis for all this. And if you think about it, if the legislature, if there was a very strong governor, and we have a very strong government, you got a statute passed. Maybe he worked very effectively with the legislature. They might be of the same party. But at the next election, and got a statute passed that somehow controlled the powers of the legislature to control itself. The next election, the leadership in the legislature changes, but the governor doesn't. And now they can't change the statute. Because they may disagree with the step that was taken before, and they change the statute, the governor can veto it.
Right.
So the courts, I think, have said, and all of this historically is based on that basic principle, the separation of powers. And I think that's directly why the court made that decision, is that, listen, the pure democracy in our society resides in the legislative body.
It does. And I think that's over and over repeated in Mason's manual. Senator French.
Thank you. I'm just trying to, again, order my thinking. I'm not sure if the point we're driving at is that the Select Committee on Ethics is without power to stand in judgment of acts of that happen inside the building in general because of the analysis you've suggested, or if you're saying in this specific instance, because it was on the agenda to talk about this advisory opinion 0403, is it your thrust that we need to redo the structure of the Select Committee on Ethics through amendments to the uniform rules, or is it your point that this specific opinion 0403 was invalid because in your view they looked to a statute when they should have looked to custom or some other rule?
Hey, Senator French, I believe my intent as we go through the ethics laws is to try to come out with a final product that eliminates potential conflicts that are constitutional conflicts, and also to put yardsticks where we need to have something to measure, so we have the clear, bright lines that we have to. I believe that the ethics statutes control individual behavior under certain circumstances, but is not that that doesn't that that it, that that I believe that the Ethics Committee never had the ability to rule on parliamentary procedure within the body. That was always something that could never be delegated because of the uniform rules. So it was improper even to delegate that responsibility in the first place. Secondly, we talked about guidelines. Guidelines on parliamentary procedure, where the Ethics Committee made recommendations about guidelines, if never adopted as part of the uniform rules, would never be part of the uniform rules. So why were we tasking someone to develop guidelines? We don't anymore. Now we say, I think the statute now says, according to these guidelines, and I haven't looked at that statute to find out yet if those guidelines violate the uniform rules. And if we adopted that statute in the 23rd legislature, according to the uniform rules, as of the convening of the 24th legislature, that statute no longer had effect on the uniform rules of the legislature. It was gone because no past legislature can bind this legislature on its uniform rules. So we have a conflict that needs to be squared away. Now, as to the opinion from the committee on the 0403, reading through it, I find that I disagree with the opinion on several points. I don't believe that the notice requirements ever in the uniform rules required notice of the subject matter of a bill, but that they noticed the required subject matter of the meeting. The subject matter of the meeting has, by usage, always been bills previously heard or considered, introduced, or whatever. That has been the usage that has been established by the legislature, which would then become part of the uniform rules. And only by a vote or by a raising of a point of order with a ruling to establish a precedent, or by a vote of the members, would that rule be changed, that it could not be changed by a statute. Because that isn't the body adopting its own rules. So it's a complicated situation, but it's one that needs to be squared away. So I think probably, in my opinion, based on what I read in the uniform rules, they have no authority to review the uniform rules. So therefore, I'm not going to get into the substance of the decision, but I just think that they never had, we could not even give them that authority, ever, according to the uniform rules. Go ahead.
Well, let me just offer a slightly different analysis.
I anticipated there might be.
We began 20 minutes ago with section 13, page 22 in Mason's, and rule 3, I think that's where we started. And the rule reads that the power of a house, of a legislature, to determine its rules of proceedings is a continuous power, can always be exercised by the house, and is absolute and beyond the challenge of any body or tribunal if the rule does not ignore constitutional restraints or violate fundamental rights. And I think right there is sort of a crucial stopping point before you go any further. Because as I analyze this ethics opinion 0403 and what happened up there in finance, my view is that one of the fundamental rights at stake here is due process of law. And due process sort of pervades everything. It's one of those great sort of basic fundamental rights that we're all entitled to, right? Due process of law. And due process is one of those subjects that you can write whole treatises on. It's in Black's Law Dictionary, it takes up about a page and a half. But it really boils down to two real simple ideas. Due process of law means notice and opportunity to be heard. Before I affect your rights, before I take action against you as a government, before I can change the way the rule is, whether it's a murder trial or a rezoning or a liquor license down the street, I've got to tell you what's going to happen and give you an opportunity to speak on it. I may resolve every question against you. I may convict you of murder. I may change the rezoning. I may allow that liquor license to lapse or be renewed. But if you had a chance to be heard, then you've gotten your due process of law. And from my view, what happened in finance was that there was not due process of law.
that that bill came up under a format that allowed no citizen to know that was going to be taken up. And that was the fundamental issue. If the bill had been listed by number, if the bill had been listed by title, case closed. And you can properly say that each citizen who wanted to pay attention would know that bill was going to be heard, and there was probably a moment when they said, is there any more testimony on this? And that citizen had the opportunity to weigh in. So it seems to me it's fairly simple to avoid the problem in 0403, and that's just to list the bills you're going to hear in a committee. And you'd avoid that problem. Well, then, and so that's kind
Senator,
of
why don't you raise that as a point of order to allow the body to vote, because that's where you establish that. You don't establish it in a committee that exists, that under the uniform rules we can't delegate that authority to.
From my view, the Constitution says you get due process of law.
The Constitution says that this is the responsibility imposed on the legislature as a state legislature, and that body is bound to exercise those rules or those duties and responsibilities, and it can't divest itself of that responsibility. So if you believe that that would be a constitutional mandate of some kind, you would have an affirmative responsibility to bring it up as a point of order. Now, I would disagree with you that the public does not have any opportunity to be able to know what could happen in that committee. If I recall the specific circumstances, the entire day was dedicated to education budget. The entire day. Secondly, in reviewing the basis system, I can tell you every bill that's pending in every committee at any time, and go back into the basis and take a look at the subject of the bill, in fact, the entire text of the bill. So if I'm an interested person that's following a particular subject, I know exactly what's available in any committee at any time when bills that have that are noticed under bills previously heard. And so the public does have an opportunity, if they want to click the key a couple of times, to be able to find that. And it's not a difficult system. The next thing is, since I've been in the legislature, and since I've observed the legislature, which has been many, many years, and Senator Terrio, you've got the seniority here, tell me if I'm wrong, that has been the custom and usage of the legislature for as long as I can recall. Am I wrong?
That's been the custom. And in fact, Mr. Chairman, that the methodology used by the committee on that day has been used long time. In fact, I bet you money, used by one of the very legislators who filed the complaint. And Mr. Chairman, with regard to notice, there wasn't specifically public notice posted, but there was notice given. I know I told the minority leaders the previous day, personally. I told them. In fact, I was telling them that this was going to come up the next morning, at the same time that down the hall, in fact, I had to excuse myself from that meeting, down the hall, majority members were being told that education funding, the issue of education funding, was going to be taken up by the Finance Committee the next day.
So basically what I see is, here's the problem, Senator French. If you go by the uniform rules, which are good for everybody because they're clear, they're easy to find and to understand, but if there's a usage by the body that isn't challenged, if it's improper usage that isn't challenged by the body, it becomes a uniform rule of that legislature. So it's a very interesting process. We have, as legislatures, an affirmative responsibility that if we see a usage that is outside of the uniform rules, to challenge it as a point of order. If we do not, we have consented to its becoming part of the uniform rules. So it would appear to me that in the two senators that filed the inquiry erred in terms of parliamentary procedure and their affirmative responsibility as members of the legislature by not raising the issue as a point of order. but instead referring it to a committee in violation of the uniform rules. So I'm not trying to be critical, I'm just saying we need to also understand our affirmative responsibility if we are going to offer due process to everyone involved, that meaning to every legislator that's involved, because we all have that affirmative responsibility to understand and to operate under the uniform rules. And when we see someone operating outside of the uniform rules, to raise that point of order. Otherwise, we have consented to that becoming, by usage, part of the uniform rules. It's a big responsibility on us. We shouldn't be asking you to take our responsibilities, Joyce. That's what I'm getting around to. Because I think we do that in a manner that could take your efforts away from the other very important responsibilities that we have through legislative process assigned to the Ethics Committee, and put you in a position that I don't think you should have been in. But that's just my interpretation. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Being a new guy around here, not being restrained by experience in the legislature, I have a little. This is fascinating to me, and quite frankly, some parts of this ought to be mandatory viewing by new guys like me, because I am surprised how clear the system describes itself as far as precedence and order of merit that is laid out. And quite frankly, I recall earlier in the year voting on adopting the rules, and I naively was voting on that because I understood about it and have any idea what I was doing in retrospect. And now it's very, very clear to me. So this is a very healthy process for me. It meets a number of my litmus tests because it clears up some fog. But more important, I think, for the body, because we all have some voids in our brain based on practice and what we thought and wives' tales and all those, in some cases what we wish was the truth and turns out not to be the truth, this is a good thing. And I think for the body at large, it's good that we're going through this procedure. And if some of it we may not like, some parts of it may sort of alienate a couple of people or bodies, but it's a healthy thing in the respect that it dismisses some of the wives' tales that some of us may carry in our mind.
So I guess it all comes back to one thing, Joyce, in the discussion. Current statute, opens meetings law, which is where
2460, I believe, 037.
037, okay, which is on page A6 of the handout that we gave to the members. Paragraph B. The uniform rules of the Alaska State Legislature control the procedure for conducting open and executive sessions of a legislative body. Does that statement, in the context of this version of the Opens Meeting Law, clarify the issue that we've been discussing today in your mind, or does it need to be clarified further to be able to avoid a conflict?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, it seems that there are differing opinions from the committee today, Senator French and yourself, and so personally, I guess I would say that it needs clarification.
Okay. Understanding now that I'm going to ask you to do what your committee asked your legal counsel to do, and that is, within the context of the discussion that we've had here today, under the premise that the uniform rules control the actions of the legislature, I would like to ask you if you could give me some suggested language that would clarify that issue in your mind. We'll examine that. We'll probably have other suggestions as well, but I'm just trying to make sure that, under the premise that I think Senator Terrio, I mean, the way we've woven this together, and members, is it the intent of of the members here to delegate any responsibility having to do with the operating uniform rules of the legislature to anyone other than members of the legislature. With that in mind, and saying that I believe that our constitutional responsibility is very clearly laid out in Mason's manual, how do we avoid that in statute? And I think that's all I'm, if you have an opportunity to comment on that, I would like to have, run it past your members and see what where they are, but I want to try to avoid that conflict.
Mr. Chair, I would also suggest, since Mr. Thomas is online and he is the acting chair of the committee, that you might want to ask him for his comments.
Sure. Mr. Thomas, have you been following this discussion, I hope?
I have.
And we're certainly amenable. If you'll put yourself on the record, we'd be eager to hear any comments that you have this morning, sir.
Well, in response to your question to Joyce regarding Section B, that is the section that we looked at when we discussed this advisory opinion that you're talking about. It was that provision that we felt gave us the authority to interpret the rule. And we did ask for a legal opinion about whether or not we did have that authority. So if your intent is to make sure that the committee doesn't wander down that path again, you may consider something along the lines of another sentence in there that would indicate that the committee has no authority to interpret the uniform rules. If that's what you intend. I think something like that would have stopped us.
Ms. Thomas, excuse me for interrupting, Senator Seekins. Which legal opinion, the one that was given to you as opinion A or the one that was given to you as opinion B? Because they appear to conflict. The first opinion A, said there was no violation because it was an area that was under legislative control. And as I read the meetings of the minutes, the committee sent Ms. Craver back and said, write an opinion that shows there was a violation.
What we asked for were two different opinions. That's correct. Although we did ask her whether or not the committee had the authority to make an interpretation of the uniform rules. In this case, whether or not subject matter jurisdiction included an actual notice of the bill. And her opinion was that we did. And so that's why I say if your intent is to cut that off, then another sentence may do that. I haven't thought it all the way through, but that would have made a big difference.
I had a hard time getting that out of the printed minutes that it was her opinion. I got the opinion that, reading in the minutes, that it was the opinion of the committee that was and instructed her to write an opinion to state that.
No, we asked her specifically whether or not we had the authority to interpret the uniform rules.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio.
It just seems like, I know you've put a lot of time into this. You know, you've talked to me a couple times, and I've been kind of, what's it got to do with the gas pipeline?
Right.
And now you've sort of, linked the documents together here, and I think perhaps we need to go back to our legal advisors, perhaps write to Ms. Cook, and basically say, is this the correct interpretation? Ms. Craver may have been just operating under the assumption, well, it says so in statute, and not have gone back to look to see whether that statute could carry forward from legislature to legislature, if in fact it was ever adopted by a legislature. So that's one issue that I see that we need to have a little bit of work done on here by our legal advisors. The other one, though, is I still would like to get a copy of these two legal opinions. I would like to get a copy of at least the written minutes, and I may want to go back and listen to the tape, because if, in fact, as it's been characterized, the committee said, well, we don't like that legal interpretation, go back and write us an interpretation that gets us to this conclusion, that's very troubling to me. But I don't know that that's, in fact, what happened. But I need the documentation so I can look to see what happened. And I'd ask that you have your staff provide that to us.
We can certainly do that. And we'll, Joyce, if we have any holes or anything, we may request assistance from you to make sure that we've provided the members with everything that they need. Interesting, Mr. Thomas, let me, I didn't mean to cut you off forever, but As I looked at this, at the process, it the discussion took a point somewhere in the in an assumption that, and let me read to you from the printed minutes that I have. Member Walker asked for clarification of Rule 23A, which requires subject matter notice for bills. And I had a, when I looked at Rule 23A of the Uniform Rules, it says written notice of the time, place, and subject matter of all meetings of standing, special, and joint committees during the week shall be provided. Is there a difference in your opinion between the subject matter of a meeting and the subject matter of a bill?
I think there is a difference, yes.
So where did it go from an interpretation of Rule 23A to meaning subject matter of the meeting to Mr. Walker's indication that it should be subject matter of a bill?
I don't think I can really speak for him, but I think that the committee felt that the subject matter of the meeting was broad enough to include the subject matter of the bill. And looking at the guidelines that are referenced in the opinion, it was the general consensus, I think, of the committee that, at least in this particular instance, there should have been some notice regarding what the subject matter of the bill was in order to comply with 23. That's the sense of the committee, I think.
Did the committee look at usage?
We did discuss usage because it was brought to our attention that historically the way things have proceeded were under bills previously heard. However, the general consensus of the committee was that just because it's been done that way in the past doesn't necessarily mean that it's appropriate.
Did the committee look at Mason's Manual, Section 4, Rule 2?
I don't recall that.
Which basically says rules of legislative procedure are derived from several sources, take precedence in the order listed below. The principle.
I don't recall. I'm sorry.
Okay. I mean, that would have been pretty clarifying at that point in time to say that usage takes precedence over statute. Senator French?
But doesn't the adopted rule take precedent over custom?
It does, and if there's a question, you look at the adopted rule says if there's a question that you look at Mason's Manual.
But if the rule is clear, you don't need custom.
Obviously the rule's not very clear. They said it wasn't clear. Well, and they said the statute doesn't preclude us from doing this, so therefore we have the authority to do it.
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I read written notice of the time, place, and subject matter of all meetings, and that just seems clear to me. It says okay. We're going to tell you when we're going to meet, where we're going to meet, and what we're going to talk about. That seems clear.
And Mr. Senator French, I would say if you feel through the usage, which you have participated in for the last 3 years of the legislature, that you felt that the usage was in violation of the uniform rules, you had an affirmative responsibility to raise it as a point of order. Did you ever do that? If you did not, then usage became the uniform rule, according to the uniform rules. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, since I don't have a copy of the uniform rules here, does it talk about which
23A.
Which is on what page?
Page 11.
I'm just wondering, is that a reference to notification to who?
The notice that's given by 4 o'clock on Thursday.
It shall be provided by the person who chairs the committee to the chief clerk or secretary.
Right. By 4 o'clock on
Thursday preceding the week of the meeting.
Okay, I'll look up here.
It's very interesting in that the uniform rules say that usage becomes the uniform rule unless it's objected to. And we all have to know that.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, I guess at this point, Senator French, does that clarify it for you? You're silent on the response, but I'm just trying to make sure that that it is making sense as we're going through, because I happen to agree with what Senator Seekins is saying, but I don't know whether you do or not. I'm not asking you to agree. I'm just trying to make sure that there's some clarification.
So, I guess I would tend to disagree with that. I mean, I would tend to feel that you can't get around the Constitution by ignoring it or by violating it, that it remains the Constitution, and practice doesn't trump the Constitution, just like practice doesn't trump the uniform rules. The uniform rules remain in effect. You may, by acquiescence, go weeks and months and years by ignoring them, but if someone points out your error, you should be willing to look back at the rule and say, I guess that's right. I guess that's been clear as daylight all along, that we should have been providing subject matter notice of the bills we're going to hear. And it's a fairly small step to really do that. Most of us know what bills are going to come up. We think about them ahead of time. We have the committee aides ready to go. We have the people who are going to testify. It strikes me as being putting the cart before the horse, if you will, to try to reinvent the wheel to get around a fairly simple notice requirement. So I guess the short answer is no. I would say that the rules continue in effect despite their abeyance, if you will.
The rules can't continue in effect, though, in my opinion, Senator Huggins, unless you obey all of them. And the uniform rules say usage is the precedence over statute. And Senator French is right. If someday you wake up and say, we're doing this all wrong, he has an affirmative responsibility to raise it as a point of order and settle it within the body, and has no authority to take it outside of the body. As the Supreme Court said, they're not going to rule on the legislative procedure. Why can anyone else, other than the body? Senator Terrio.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, it's not often that the legislature gets into this level of detail, and the whole issue of a statute being passed that is, binding on future legislatures as far as their internal rules. I think if you give it a lot of thought, you go back to the Constitution and you find out, well, that's nice try, but every legislature is an independent body, and it cannot be bound by the previous ones. That's what the Constitution basically says.
That's very clear.
The onion's not been peeled back this far for years and years.
Yeah, right. Senator Huggins.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. In my mind, it gives me some comfort because it meets a common sense test. At the time that we're going through a process, that you can raise your hand and you can object, and it can refer to the body, and the body can administer itself. However, as you so deftly laid out, that what it prevents is that undermining after the fact, when you say, well, I think that I see a technicality and we'll go to this body or that body, so that you can start retrospectively making the legislature re-examine itself, which I think is unhealthy. And I, quite frankly, as I look at the procedures, there's a lot of language that prevents that from happening because we go into chaos.
And it gives direct access for any citizen who believes that we have violated our own rules by going to their legislator and saying, Senator French, I think Senator Seekins violated the open rules principles of the uniform rules by noticing bills previously heard. Would you please raise it as a point of order? I bet you would. Or you'd say, no, I don't want to, one or the other. So every citizen who feels that they've been aggrieved in the operating procedures of the legislature has the opportunity to raise that question. And then, according to the uniform rules and according to the authority of the Constitution, which says the legislature shall establish its uniform rules, not anyone else, we do that. And we do it in the light of day. And so
that's, I guess, what I'm saying. I'm not trying to do this to chastise anybody on the Ethics Committee. I think that it was an improper action to refer it to the Ethics Committee, but that the statute makes you do something that you don't have the constitutional authority to do, and we've got to make sure that the statute's very clear as to what that authority is and where it lies. That I think is my discussion, and I'm not trying to be critical. I'm saying I can understand when I read through the minutes, which are just a summation of the conversations. Maybe I need to listen to the tapes too, but not an intent of trying to criticize the action, but trying to avoid the conflict. And force the members of the body, if they have a point of order, to operate within the system of the uniform rules. Senator Terry, did you have a question, or were you scratching your head? Sorry. Ms. Thomas, you have further comment for us?
No, I don't, Senator.
Ms. Thomas, as we're reviewing the ethics laws on both the legislative side and the administrative side, Joyce has given us some input as to areas that we can make the rules more clear. Definition of the word, for example, substantial. I think you heard part of that discussion yesterday as well. If you or any members of the committee also feel that there are areas of the law that can make it easier for you to be able to operate through the principles of clarity, we would certainly appreciate any input that you have as we continue to deliberate on this question.
Okay, I appreciate that, and I'll discuss that with Joyce, and we'll try to get something to you that we can run by the committee members first.
And we do want to compliment Joyce for being here and being very candid, but yet trying to remain in the area of confidentiality that I'm sure that she lives up to very well. But further questions on this particular subject? Further discussion on it? I think we all need to take a look at this section, and if for the benefit of the members, I'll try to put together just a little dot point discussion of what my research has indicated so that you can review it as well. And I'll try to get that done in short order, because it's all in a bunch of papers, but it's not really been tied together. So, other questions, Senator Terrio? Let's just try to now to utilize the remainder of Joyce's time with us to any benefit. Joyce, do you see other areas in the bill that we can help you you folks improve with?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I think I mentioned the ones that were of concern to me, which had to do with the staggered members so that we are able to operate. And we talked about the complaint section, which I think is not ordered in a very convenient and efficient manner, trying to figure out what's going on. And we've also had some legal opinions on some of those statutes in the complaint section, which I can pull out and take a look at and see if there are some areas that might need some clarification. I think over the years, if I could just comment on a couple other sections, maybe not with suggestions, but just a couple other comments. The gift section has been updated quite a bit since it first came into being in 1993. And I think it's set up fairly well right now. When I receive a lot of questions about gifts, I feel that particular section does cover the areas that need to be covered. But what I would like to do is go back and look at my notes and see if there's any particular area that I felt might have been ambiguous in the gift section. That is a big area that I deal with. And for your information, I think I had mentioned earlier, I do put together when I receive, I keep track of the calls that I receive for informal advice, and I mentioned yesterday that I give the committee a quick question and answer section that they review at each meeting. So I'd like to go over those and take a look at them. There have been some questions that have come in where I felt that the individual needed to request an advisory opinion because it may have been something that I didn't feel was very, very well defined in the ethics code, and I'd like to look and see what some of those questions were. Okay. Even during, not just during my tenure, but there might have been some during the previous person. So the gift section, I think, has been set up. I do believe there is one section, and I don't have that information with me, where under the disclosure section.
Which is what part of the bill?
The disclosure section has to do, it starts with about 2460-040, goes in with contracts and leases, and then to 050, state programs and loans. And there's one of those particular sections, and I'm not sure which one, that does not have a particular time frame for filing. And the committee has taken the position that since all disclosures are due by March 15th, that one should be as well. So that might be just a minor clarification that we could put in there. So that's one that I can think of. But I would like to go back and take a look at some of the other sections and then let you know.
We'd really appreciate that. I mean, we hope to come out with a product as soon as we can that can cover some of the whole. There's some black holes here and there, some improvements that we can make, some clarifications for the benefit of the committee, for the legislature, and for anyone else that's trying to interpret the code. And so anything that we can do there, I think, would be well worthwhile.
Okay.
Other questions for Joyce?
Not for Joyce.
Senator French.
Not for Joyce. I'm just, I appreciate the amount of work you put into this and thought, Senator Seekinson. So I just jotted down what I took to be two of the central points you've made, and just so I understand them. And so perhaps as you're putting together your material, you'll have them in mind as well. And point number one was that it seemed to be you're suggesting that a legislator must raise as a point of order whatever his or her objection, raise a point of order to the committee practice he or she, or floor practice he or she finds objectionable, prior to referring that matter to the select committee? Or is it that you feel that it can only be resolved inside the body through the decision on that point of order, and that's not appealable outside the legislative ethics committee? You see my question, and I'm not asking for a final answer. I'm just trying to articulate.
To give you an idea there, mm-hmm. I do believe that anything having to do with the legislative procedure that's covered under the uniform rules, the only place that you can resolve the issue is within the body.
So the select committee has no subject matter jurisdiction over its own doings, the legislature's doings.
Well, I believe that's probably how I would interpret the rules.
Okay,
that's when I look at the rules, if we have a rule, we can change it tomorrow by a vote of 50 of a majority vote.
And the other point I jotted down was that, and it sounds like this is sort of another major thrust of where your thinking is going, is that the statutes that do pertain to the select committee and how they're authorized, those must be reauthorized each legislature, because they somehow bind us and we can't bind a future legislature.
In terms of our operating rules, the legislative procedure, yes, I believe that.
And unless they're reauthorized, they're null.
Unless they become part of the uniform rules, they have no control over legislative procedure. If there's anything higher on the hierarchy list that would control it, or that would trump it.
Well,
statutory provision would only prevail if there is nothing above it that said otherwise. That's basically how I understand the rules. But I'll prepare that. I will try to do that.
Appreciate that.
Okay. Further questions, members? This has been a very interesting, if long and boring for a lot of people, discussion, but I think a very important one, because I think it's very important that we properly task the ethics committee, and we don't waste anybody's time if there's any indication that there are areas of responsibility that do or don't exist. So with that, unless there are other questions from any of the members at this point or comments, we are adjourned.